The date is August 18th, 1988. The interviewer is Jim Strassmeyer for the Oregon Historical Society. This is tape 6, side 1. I wondered if we could start this morning by picking up a subject, a sort of isolated subject that I encountered going into the scrapbooks. And it's from the year 1959. You had an invitation from Richard Nixon to participate in a goals committee. I wonder if you could tell me about that. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do. The invitation came as a result of a friendship with Charles Percy. Charles Percy was head of Bell and Howell, the film people. Mm-hmm. And I was acquainted with him through our association at Mar and Frank, where Bell and Howell was one of our suppliers. Now, Chuck Percy was also a prominent Republican, and he was asked by Richard Nixon to head a goals committee for Mr. Nixon for the 1960 campaign. And it was through that connection that I was asked by the Vice President then, and by Charles Percy, to become a part of that goals committee. Unfortunately, I felt I had to turn it down because we were just getting ourselves established with the new store in Salem, and I was very deeply involved in Senator Hatfield's campaign, and I just felt I didn't have the time to do it because it would have meant a good deal of travel. Looking back on it, I regret that I didn't do it because I would have enjoyed it and I thought it would have been a very interesting assignment. As it so happened, Chuck Percy and I have maintained a friendship over the years, and later, of course, he was to become a United States Senator, and our paths did cross many times. And as a matter of fact, he came out to Willamette to speak at one of our commencements, and I had the privilege of introducing him and being with him at that time.
Mm-hmm. So the relationship continued for...
For many years, and still does. Uh-huh. I just saw him a couple of weeks ago at an affair in Washington, and that friendship does continue.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. I'm glad to have that filled in. It was something that really caught my attention. How about your experience of Richard Nixon? When did that begin, and was that substantial earlier?
All right. My associations with Richard Nixon started during the Oregon Centennial, which would have been... The 100th year was 1959. Uh-huh. And Richard Nixon came out to Oregon to be a featured speaker for the centennial celebration. And Senator Hatfield was governor at that time. And he had a small luncheon at his apartment with just Antoinette, the senator, Richard Nixon, and myself. Mm-hmm. And it was in the very modest apartment that he had. And I was very impressed with Richard Nixon, that he is an extremely intelligent person, not an easy person to be around, not comfortable, but fascinating. Well, it was as a result of that luncheon that the incident that you talked about earlier and the question that you asked about the goals committee, I think that that was when he perhaps evaluated whether I could have been of assistance to him. And then our associations developed over the years a number of times. During the presidency, I was invited several times to the White House for various affairs. I was the contact person from Senator Hatfield to the Nixon organization at the Miami Convention in 1968. Mm-hmm. When the senator was being looked at for a possible vice president's bid, the senator was also to deliver a major speech at that convention, and I was the person who worked with the Nixon people on the arrangements and on the senator's remarks for that occasion. After Mr. Nixon left the White House, I visited with him at San Clemente with the senator and had a chance to see him several times in other situations. There was a dinner that the senator had at his home in Washington with the vice president as a featured speaker or guest, actually. There were seven or eight of us there, including Senator Fulbright and Jim Evans, the head of Union Pacific, and Senator Howard Baker. We had a wonderful evening, one of the most fascinating evenings that I have ever been through, where we had a chance to visit with Mr. Nixon. He talked the entire evening about his recollections of incidents and world leaders that he had been associated with, and it was a superb evening. The next time I was invited to a luncheon for some mutual friends at the vice president's home, and Mr. Nixon came as a guest. This was Vice President Bush's home, and Mr. Nixon came as a guest, and we had a chance to visit. I've seen him at several meetings where he has spoken. I'm in touch with him regularly. Last fall, that would be in September of 1987, when the new edition of my book came out, Mr. Nixon very thoughtfully sent a personal telegram of congratulations to me, and he keeps me on his mailing list for copies of his speeches, and it has been a long-time association.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. I'm glad to have the whole history of it, and it will certainly fit into later discussions that we'll be entering during the Nixon administration. What if we could get back to the chronology at the point where well, say around 1964, 1965. I wonder if you could help us to recreate the development or the genesis of Mark Hatfield's thinking on Vietnam. I know we've touched on it some already, but if we could kind of reconstruct as much as we can of how that thinking formed. And perhaps you would recall some conversations with Mark Hatfield in these early years of his Vietnam involvement.
Well, to be honest with you, Vietnam was a very distant subject for me when the entire affair came up, because my war experiences were on the other side of the globe, and Vietnam was a very distant part of the world to me. The senator, of course, was in the Far East, and this was much more vivid in his mind and much more personal because he had been in that area during World War II. He had seen the devastation in the area. He was knew of the major players. He visited the devastation of the first atomic bomb. And I think all of this left a very profound effect upon him. And I think that his Vietnam policies that were formulated years and years later were as a result of his personal experiences and also his very strong belief in the sanctity of human life, which permeates his whole thinking on any variety of issues. And this was something that he understood the genesis of the problems in Vietnam more than the average person. The problem was that he had difficulty in articulating them because there had to be so much background given for people who really didn't understand what the conflict was and didn't understand why we should or shouldn't be there. He knew himself why he thought we shouldn't be there. But the electorate, and particularly the people who were Hatfield supporters, the business folks and those who had very strong red, white, and blue feelings, felt that we had to back the president no matter what. And he saw it a little bit farther, and as we had talked earlier, this almost lost him the first go-round in the war election to the Senate, and it made it very difficult. If it hadn't been for his strong record as governor, he probably would have lost to Bob Duncan, who was, as we've talked, was able to say, I support the president in the war effort, and the senator couldn't say that so quickly. He didn't support it, but he had to go through a long explanation of why he didn't. Well, as the war went on longer, of course there were conversations. I was not a major player in the policy side of that, because I really didn't have the background in it. And I must say that I had some question because my inclinations were support of the president, and being in the military, I felt, you know, that whatever we got into on the military basis was right. So there was a bit of education as far as I was concerned, but I could see more and more what the senator's views were and why he had them. And of course, publicly, I supported him all along the way, and privately became convinced also that it was the right position. So it was of major concern, and of course, he stood out as the one individual who stood up against President Johnson, against his policies.
Mm-hmm. Well, were you at times attempting to get him to soften his statements on Vietnam, or
I was only from a political standpoint, because my job was as his campaign manager, of course, was to ensure that his base of support was as broad as possible. And many of the people that I came in contact with were very critical of him because of his Vietnam stand. Publicly, of course, I supported it, but I have to say privately that, yes, we did talk a bit about it, and as I gained more knowledge, my desire to have him softened it became a lesson, because I could see his point, but it was certainly a very sticky wicket politically. But he obviously, as history has shown, was right, and not only myself, but many others who held views that weren't as strong as his came to understand why he felt the way he did.
Mm-hmm. Well, were there others around, or I should say, who were individuals around him who were sympathetic to his views and gave him direct support?
Well, no question about that, that the great majority of the staff members, the younger staff members, I think were really attracted to him because of his Vietnam views, that they, of course, shared them, and they wanted to be around someone who was in a position to do something about it. And yes, the majority of the staff were very supportive, particularly people like Wes Michelson, who was his chief legislative assistant, speechwriter, confidant, and a very able person, and he was strongly supportive of the senator's Vietnam position.
Mm-hmm. What about in the governor's years, 64 and 65? I'm wondering if Mark Hatfield is a man practically alone, even among his own staff and circle of friends. Who stands with him on that issue?
Well, in the governor's days, there would have to be a very different situation. There was really no one on his staff at that time who was very strongly supportive of his Vietnam position. I would say that that they probably were more supportive of the general feeling of the electorate. Travis Cross would be one who would have to enunciate the senator's position, but I don't think that he himself was I think he had to be convinced, let's put it that
mm-hmm.
way.
So it really does sound like he was pretty much alone.
I mean, very much
quite
so.
Alone.
Very much so. And he had a great deal of instruction to do and educating to do with his own staff mm-hmm. as well as with the
mm-hmm.
electorate.
Mm-hmm. And how about Antoinette?
Well, Antoinette has been supportive of his positions always, and I don't think that Vietnam was a big thing in her life, but she certainly was supportive of his
mm-hmm.
position.
Mm-hmm. Well, it really makes it a phenomenal thing, just put simply, that he began this work alone, virtually alone. At governor's conferences, he would encounter some sympathy, and a couple of people, Romney, for instance, were willing to stand up.
They gave him a pat on the back and say, "Yes, Mark, you know, we think you're doing the right thing." But when it came down to support of putting their name on the line, the senator was the only one of the governors who stood up against Lyndon Johnson, and it was not easy, and he created a lot of character for himself, but he certainly was an outcast as far as the administration was concerned and as far as his contemporaries were concerned.
Mm-hmm. I think at the time, one of the newspaper reports, a statement appears that there were sympathetic individuals, but that the Hatfield staff or Hatfield himself didn't feel they were in a position to name them. So can you name some of these people who were supportive at this time?
Well, you named one of them. George Romney certainly was supportive. I'm sure there were others. I can't really recall who else there was came to him with that kind of feeling, but I've heard the senator say that there were others who came up to him and did applaud him for his views.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed that people were very divided about it. The Albany Democrat Herald, for instance, came out in support of Hatfield in spite of the fact that they disagreed with him. They agreed with Duncan on the issue. Is there some history to get into of working to get the media favorably disposed to Hatfield, willing to make this kind of a commitment, the Oregonian and other newspapers?
Well, yes, there is some background in that, that during his political career as state representative, state senator, secretary of state, and governor, he naturally was under close inspection by the media, and they got to know him very well as an individual and saw the kind of person he was and the caliber of individual that he was. And he did make a number of friends in the press, and it is very important to say that Travis Cross, who was his press secretary, was a very able person and very well respected and well liked by the people in the media and very professional about it. So the senator did build a strong base of support, and I think the reason that you saw so many of the newspapers around the state support him in his a re-election campaign for governor and in his race for the Senate was not because of the Vietnam position, because I think particularly the Oregonian was very hawkish and were absolutely diametrically opposed to the senator's position, and strongly so. But they were looking at it from a broader aspect, and I have to tell you that we had to work on that, that mm-hmm. this didn't just come easily. They were predisposed to be friendly to him, but we had a lot of good friends, and you mentioned the Albany Democrat Herald in particular. Well, it so happened that the editor there was a very good friend. Glenn Cushman was a good friend of ours, and he was very supportive of the senator, and that paper was owned by Glenn Jackson, who also was very supportive of the senator. So although they may have disagreed philosophically with him, they you know, they took a very mature view that it's not really the issue. You can disagree on an issue, but it's the person, and that's what you're really supporting or buying. And that's why they put their name on the Hatfield bandwagon.
Mm-hmm. The whole campaign was described by one of the journalists as one of the slickest campaigns in Oregon history.
And, now, which campaign are you talking about?
This is the campaign of 66.
The first campaign for the Senate.
Yes, right. And then they described some of the operations, and they mentioned the principal people involved, and would be Travis Cross, yourself, and Richard Turner. And occasionally in some of the writings at this time, there's a mention of a Robert Price, but I don't know if he played a role. But I wonder if you could kind of give a kind of an inside view of how you were operating that campaign.
Robert Price was not a major player. Mm-hmm. Travis Cross, Dick Turner, were indeed very major players. Travis Cross, of course, had been the senator's press secretary, close confidant for many years, and a very astute person politically. Richard Turner, strong Republican background, was in the advertising and public relations business in Portland, had been active in Nelson Rockefeller's campaigns, and was very supportive of the senator, had been the PR and advertising person in previous campaigns, and much of the public image part of it was Dick Turner's work. Mm-hmm. So we did work very closely together. Warren Nunn also would have been a major player in the campaign. He was the governor's, Governor Hatfield's chief of staff. He was very close to it. Glenn Jackson was very supportive in that campaign and played a back scenes part. But we had a number of strong people who supported us in that campaign, including Dick Jones, who continues even to this day to be very supportive of the center. He was a professor of history at Reed College, a Republican liberal. We had lots of young people throughout the state who agreed with the center's Vietnam views. You described the campaign as slick. I would not describe it that way. I would say that it was a tough mm-hmm. campaign. Bob Duncan was a formidable candidate, a wonderful gentleman who I think we've talked earlier on these tapes, has since became a very strong supporter and personal friend of the senator and of myself. I think, in fairness, looking back, if Bob Duncan had run a more organized campaign and had been more of a detailist, less of a nice guy, and had been as well organized as we were, we might have had a really tougher time. As it was, we won by a narrow margin. Bob had a lot of things going for him because of the Vietnam situation. The senator had it going for him because of his strong record in popularity as governor. But that campaign was nip and tuck, and Bob Duncan, in all fairness, did not run a very professional campaign. And I think we did. Mm-hmm. And we ran a typical Hatfield-type campaign, which was nitty-gritty organized. It, we took advantage of every type of organization and group and meeting, and we worked hard at it. The senator worked very hard, and we used every tool that we could, and that's why we won.
Mm-hmm. You describe, I should get back to the term slickest. I'm not sure exactly how there is a way of using the term slick, which is not negative anyway. That may have been the intention. When you use the term nice guy, I'm curious what would exemplify that.
Well, Bob Duncan is a gentleman, and in this business, in the heat of a campaign, many times you see people who take below the belt jibes and who do things that are unprofessional. Bob Duncan never did that. He's a decent, intelligent soul who ran the campaign on issues, not on personalities. And he was always fair, square, honest. I would have nothing but the strongest words of support and appreciation for the kind of campaign he ran. He was a respected, tough opponent, and kept us on our toes, and it was a nice person to be around. In other words, if we met him on the campaign trail, it was a gentlemanly, professional, business type association between friends. And it wasn't a matter of ignoring somebody or being nasty to them, as you so many times see in political campaigns.
But still, there were moments of ineptness in his campaign.
Well, there were moments of ineptness, perhaps because Bob Duncan enjoys the issue part in the big picture and is not the kind of guy who enjoys the backroom political organization, which is so necessary in this business. And if there was ineptness, it was because he had other priorities. I mean, for example, maybe he wouldn't pay attention to the scheduling. He'd let somebody else do it, and they'd miss a meeting, and he wouldn't show up. Well, that reflects